This is Adam Blake Wright from Iowa State University's Sustainable Agriculture Graduate Program, and you are listening to KHOI Story City Ames, community radio for the heart of Iowa.
Welcome to Local Talk Monday, where we explore the people, places, stories, and events of our central Iowa community. Thank you for tuning in. I am Mike Metz, your host for the hour, along with station manager and engineer Mike Murphy. We will see sunshine later today with a number of cloudy intervals. Starting out cloudy this morning, our high will be a comfortable 79 degrees. North winds are 10 to 15 miles per hour, and there's a chance of various showers. Our current temperature is a comfortable 67 degrees. Let's welcome Dennis Hart with his news summary of the week from the pages of our local papers.
Bad news for the state's corn and soybean crops. That Kansas vote on abortion. And an emotional goodbye ceremony for Cedar Falls family members killed at a state park. All part of what made big news around Iowa last week. First, word on Iowa's agriculture. The U.S. Drought Monitor showed late last week that nearly 31% of the state is experiencing moderate to extreme drought. The week earlier, just 17% of the state was in that condition. Corn needs moisture to fill out kernels, and soybeans need it to blossom. The state's corn crop was rated 76% good or excellent last week, before the heat started, and that was down from 80% the previous week. Soybeans were rated 73% good or excellent, down from 75%. And in another drought-related story, word that the Des Moines Water Works, which serves 600,000 people in central Iowa, will put up flashboards across a lowhead dam in the Raccoon River this week to ensure it has an adequate pool of water to draw from. It will be the third year in a row the utility has resorted to that measure. The waterworks is not yet calling for customers to conserve water, only that they use water wisely. Now, the vote in Kansas. Voters in that state overwhelmingly rejected a proposed constitutional amendment last week that would have cleared the way for Republican lawmakers there to ban abortion. It was a vote that made nationwide news and raised questions about what that might mean for the future of abortion here in Iowa. Abortion is legal here, but Governor Reynolds has made it clear she would like to restrict it. The state Supreme Court ruled earlier this summer that Iowa's Constitution does not guarantee the right to an abortion, and steps have been taken to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot in Iowa in future years that would clarify there is no right to abortion. Meanwhile, last week, Planned Parenthood and the American Civil Liberties Union announced they were giving up their fight against an Iowa law mandating a 24-hour waiting period for abortions. The groups had sued to block the 2020 law, which requires a patient who makes an appointment for an abortion to attend a second appointment, at least a day later, before being permitted to undergo the procedure. Planned Parenthood wants to focus its energies on other abortion-related challenges. Planned Parenthood was already adhering to the 24-hour delay requirement. Also last week, word that there were fewer abortions in Iowa last year than in 2020. That marked the first time in 3 years that the annual number of abortions had gone down in the state. There were 3,761 abortions in Iowa last year, 7% less compared to 2020, when 4,058 abortions were performed in the state. In the mid-2000s, pregnancy terminations numbered more than 6,000 in the state. And last week, President Biden signed an executive order to help ensure access to abortion. That order helps women travel out of state to receive abortions, paving the way for Medicaid to cover abortion-related costs for people who have traveled from states where abortion is banned to states where it is not. And it ensures health care providers comply with federal law so women aren't delayed in getting care. On the coronavirus front in Iowa last week, the number of hospitalizations from the virus rose by 25%, and the number requiring intensive care nearly doubled. Hospitalizations in the state from the virus rose to 309, the most since the end of February. The number of people requiring intensive care for the coronavirus went up from 22 to 41. Meanwhile, the number of new virus cases remained somewhat stable in Iowa. 5,768 new cases were reported, or about 824 a day. That's the second most cases reported in a single week since the start of March. And the death toll from the virus went up in Iowa. 35 new deaths were reported, bringing the total number of virus-related deaths in the state to 9,817 since the pandemic started. In a health-related story, word last week that an Iowa nursing home that closed last month in the wake of an emergency court ruling that residents there were at risk has been added to the list of the nation's worst care facilities. The 125-bed Touchstone Healthcare Community in Sioux City was added to the Federal Centers for Medicaid and Medicaid Services list of care facilities eligible for designation as a special focus facility. The last of its residents have been moved out. Also last week, word that Iowa would be getting part of a $6.5 billion opioid settlement. A former opioid manufacturer and a pharmaceutical company that acquired part of its business have agreed to pay that amount in a settlement with a dozen states, including Iowa. Iowa and the other states had accused Allergan of downplaying the risk of addiction to its generic opioids and failing to take enough action to prevent the drugs, intended for chronic pain patients, from being diverted to illegal trade. The opioid addiction and overdose epidemic has been linked to more than 500,000 deaths in the United States over the past two decades. In Cedar Falls last Tuesday night, the community held an emotional memorial for three family members who had been killed at Maquoketa Caves State Park. Tyler Schmidt, his wife Sarah, and their six-year-old daughter Lula were killed while they were camping. Their nine-year-old son Arlo survived the attack. At the memorial in Cedar Falls, friends of the Schmidts read letters filled with loving messages and with words of hope for Arlo. Meanwhile, autopsy results were released, showing the victims had died from either gunshot wounds, stab wounds, or strangulation, depending on the person. The suspected killer, a man from Nebraska, died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Also last week, a former Ames resident was sentenced to life in prison without the chance of parole for killing a woman. A Story County judge called what 27-year-old Oscar Chavez did to Maria Hanyan in Ames, in the judge's words, nothing less than torture. Last August, Chavez beat, assaulted, and shot Hanyan seven times. He claimed he did it because he thought she had given him HIV. It turned out she did not have HIV. The judge said, again in her words, I need to protect the community from you, Mr. Chavez, then sent him to prison for life. And last week, a former Quad Cities police officer who had pleaded guilty to sexual misconduct with a 14-year-old girl was sentenced to up to 10 years in prison. 24-year-old Andrew DeNoyer had worked for the Eldridge Police Department. And in another case, the former head of the Iowa Greyhound Association was sentenced to 15 months in prison after pleading guilty to illegally selling thousands of doses of controlled substances and misbranded prescription drugs. 57-year-old John Stidham had sold more than 300,000 doses of a controlled substance without valid prescriptions, and he illegally distributed more than 50 types of misbranded prescription drugs without a valid prescription. And still on the court beat, word last week that a Des Moines man who was seen at the front of a pack of rioters inside the U.S. Capitol on January 6th last year will stand trial next month. A judge ruled last week that Doug Jensen's trial will start in Washington, D.C. the week of September 19th. Jensen's lawyer had filed a motion to delay the trial until next February to get what the lawyer called a less politically charged jury pool. The judge denied that motion. And last week, an Iowa judge denied a request to reduce a $70,000 fine imposed against the owners of Eastern Iowa's shut-down Cricket Hollow Zoo. The zoo's owners had asked the judge to reduce the fine they face for contempt of court. The judge refused to change the ruling that calls for the couple to pay a fine of $70,000 or serve a one-day sentence for each animal that was not recovered from their zoo. That would be 140 days. Their zoo was shut down because of numerous violations of animal neglect laws. There was also word last week that Iowa continues to lead the nation in puppy mills cited by the federal government for regulatory violations. During the second quarter of this year, 23 Iowa breeders and brokers were cited. That's the most in the nation. Missouri is second with 13 breeders. Iowa's second quarter total of 23 is a 21% increase over the number of violators cited in the first quarter of the year. On the phone scam beat, word last week that Iowa's Attorney General Office has joined with others across the nation to form a task force aimed at curtailing illegal robocalls in the U.S. The goal is to investigate and shut down telecommunications providers who profit from failing to stop illegal scam calls. More than 23 million scam robocalls are made to Americans every day, amounting to about 1,500 calls every second. On the school beat last week, word that a conservative group calling itself Parents Defending Education is suing the Linmar Community School District over its policy of facilitating students' gender identity transitions without parental notice. The lawsuit alleges the Eastern Iowa School District is flouting nearly a century of Supreme Court precedent that says parents have a constitutional interest in the care and control of their children. Under the district policy, a student can request a gender support plan, and the school will meet with the students in 10 days. The policy states that the student should agree with who is part of the meeting, including whether their parent or guardian will take part. And one more note before I go, and it's a gasser. Actually, it's about gas, the price we pay for it at the pump. The average price of unleaded gas in Iowa dropped to about $3.77 late last week, and it was even lower in the Des Moines Metro, where it was $3.58 a gallon. That's more than a dollar lower than it was in mid-June, though it's still higher than it was a year ago when it was $3 a gallon. But the takeaway from all this is that only the state of Missouri has a lower average gas price than we do, and there, it's only 1 cent lower. So now you know. And that, my friends, is your summary of the week's news from all around Iowa. Thanks for listening. I'm Dennis Hart, walking, not driving, my way out of here now, but planning to stroll right back here into KHOI tonight at 7 for Capital Week, when Laura Bell and I will discuss everything that's been going on in Iowa politics and what it all means. Then, just for good measure, I'll come right back to Local Talk this Friday morning at 7, when I'll report on what's making news in Ames. And I'd be pleased if you'd come along as well. Until then, let's both try to have a safe, healthy, and happy week.
And thank you, Dennis Hart, with your great summary of the news. Dennis and Laura, as Dennis indicated, will team up this evening for Capital Week, so please be sure to tune in to KHOI at 7 p.m. for their summary and discussion of the happenings that occur under the Golden Dome. And if you're just tuning in, it's about 15 minutes after the hour. I am Mike Metz, along with Mike Murphy. I recently had an opportunity to ride along on a survey with Dr. Tyler Harms. It's called the August Roadside Survey.
Dr. Tyler Harms, biometrician with the Department of Natural Resources. How long is your survey trail?
We're running about 30 miles this month.
Okay, so right now you're putting in your starting data?
That's right.
Which is weather conditions?
Mostly weather conditions, yep, and the basic metadata for the surveys. Date, time that we start, time of sunrise, all of those things are important and to include so that we make sure that we're standardizing our effort for the survey.
Very similar to some of the other surveys that are conducted then.
Very similar, yep. In fact, most wildlife surveys that we conduct include some sort of weather data collection at the start.
Okay. So Dr. Harms, how long have you been running this survey?
I started running this survey about 5 years ago now when I started with the DNR.
If I recall, Pat Schlierbaum ran at least a portion of this same survey route.
That's my understanding, yes.
Is this called a pheasant survey or a game bird survey, or what is this called?
So we call it the August Roadside Survey. And the reason for that is because while we are counting game birds like pheasants and partridge, we also count other critters as well, like cottontail rabbits.
And I noted when we first began, you marked with GPS the location of some killdeer. Just briefly tell me what that is about.
That's an entirely different effort from the roadside survey, but another project that we have currently ongoing with the DNR is capturing killdeer and collecting samples from them to look at prevalence of highly pathogenic avian influenza, HPAI.
And then I guess the other question I have, you might not be able to answer this, since you're the biometrician for the DNR, right?
That's right.
You probably know, how many of these August survey routes are there in the state?
Oh, I don't know actually, but it's at least one in every county, if not more than that.
Okay.
And I know, actually, I know it's more than that.
Gotcha. So you indicated you're keeping track of the birds and cottontail rabbits. What other interesting things have you seen running this route in the last 5 years or so?
Well, it's fun, you know, because it's perhaps not surprising when you get up early, when all the critters are waking up, you start to see quite a few neat things. And so we just saw a few deer along the route here, and other bird species, songbirds mostly. So we had an indigo bunting just up the road. I saw a shrike once last year when I ran this route, and sometimes some other neat mammals as well. I've seen a badger along this route before. So it's fun. It's always, you never know what's going to come up around the corner.
That's part of the whole thing about getting up just before sunrise and things are waking up and you're getting to see what a lot of folks never get to see or
right.
Take time to see.
That's a Dixus there.
That was a Dixus up there.
This bird, but it's probably a mourning dove making me think that it's a baby pheasant in the middle of the road.
Gotcha.
And that is indeed what it is. Mourning,
mourning dove.
They are very, very abundant along this route, and they look strikingly similar to a small game bird, so they're always fooling me.
Well, technically they are a game bird
they
now.
They are.
For the duck hunters, in the early teal season, they're fly somewhat similar to a blue-winged teal at times. You can be faked out.
They do indeed.
That's why it's important for, if people are out photography or hunting, you get out year-round to learn what things look like, how they act, and your identification skills are much better.
That's right.
Those two look like a sparrow of some type, or what?
There's
a pair of them.
Yes. A lot of dick sizzles along this road. Sparrow-like bird.
Look like miniature meadowlark as far as their pattern.
Sure.
Okay, so now we've stopped and we're sitting at a block of CRP, Conservation Reserve. What have you seen around here on the route?
I've seen pheasants along here and also a gray partridge brood along this block of CRP. Last year they had mowed the boundary almost like a fire break.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really nice spot to stop and look because the grass was shorter, obviously, and so the birds would come out into that shorter grass and get out of the dew. But you can see there, Mike, the dew's really heavy out in that CRP.
Boy, that foxtail, the sun is shining. There's a lot of backlighting in the plants, so you can just see the dew sitting on the plants.
The other thing, and we had a bird flush off the power line here. It reminded me, I always see a kestrel pair along this stretch as well near this CRP. A
couple of birds on the wire, red-winged blackbird. I don't know what that other one. The reason you run this early in the morning and you try to pick days where the dew is heavy is the birds come out along the road to dry off their plumage.
That's right. Yep, especially on sunny days like we have this morning.
Well, you probably wouldn't be running this if it were an overcast day, or at least the night before where the dew could not form. The birds and other critters would be active in the cover as opposed to the roadside.
Yeah, that's right. We try to do it on mornings with heavy dew, and that could be... It's hard to predict sometimes. You know, we have some factors that we look at that the night before or a few days before that can help us predict which mornings might have heavier dew than the others. We do our best, and again, it is a survey, right? So we know that from the start that we're not going to count everybody that's out here, and I've certainly ran this route on mornings where I didn't count anything. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's nothing there. It just means that conditions aren't right and that I didn't see them. Look at what we have here. Blackbirds or starlings. This is time of year when blackbirds really start to congregate. These pretty migratory flocks.
Yeah.
You'll see them along the gravel roads.
Who's that little guy there? Acting like a sparrow of some kind, right there. There's north of me. I'll bet I counted over 200 tree swallows over the past week or so. Yeah. They're
starting to group up too.
Yes.
They? Well, and the morning doves too. We made commented earlier. I'm really starting to see more of those around as well, which makes me think that they're starting to move a bit.
What do you got there, Tyler?
Upland sandpiper standing in the washed out or open area in this bean field.
Those folks that think of sandpipers, they think of those little birds that run across the beach areas and that. This is a little different bird.
It is. Belongs to the family called the shorebirds, which is also a bit of a misnomer for this bird because it's not typically found anywhere near water, much the same as a killdeer, which is a common shorebird that we see that's, again, not always seen near water, though they can be more so than the upland sandpiper. Upland sandpiper, they are one of the shorebirds that do very well in agricultural landscapes, much like what we're seeing right here. In fact, they will build nests in soybean fields, soybean stubble.
So these birds will nest here this time of year.
Yep.
And then, like many of the shorebirds, will...
Here comes the second one now.
Oh, yeah, coming right out of the beans.
Scanning a bit, just wondering to myself if maybe we would see a couple little sandpiper fluff balls running around out there, but I'm not seeing any.
The shorebirds are actually moving. They're on migration already, headed south.
They are, yeah. These two birds, I'm betting, were probably here all summer, just kind of the way that they're acting and where they are right now. Just a really neat bird, and if you're ever lucky enough to hear one vocalize, the males have a really, what starts out as like a bubbly upward trill and then ends with a downward pitched whistle that they'll do. Usually they'll do it in flight.
I've described it as kind of a wolf whistle.
Wolf whistle.
That a male human would do when he saw a female human.
that's a good description as well.
Yeah. Okay, so that was a great partridge.
Yeah, had a couple adult, a pair of adults, and a single chick great partridge, which is a neat observation, not one that I see every year along this route, so it's always fun to see partridge broods.
We just saw the single, and we tried to locate others, but do you know what an average brood size would be for great partridge, Tyler?
I don't know. I think they can be about the same size as a pheasant brood, maybe on average, 8-10.
At the very most, at least for the first attempt.
Right, yeah. So the fact that we saw just a single chick is a little concerning. You know, who knows what may have happened to any others that could have potentially been in the brood. But partridges are the great partridge is notorious for what we call gang brooding, where you see multiple adults kind of bring their all their broods together and what one might, or at least the parent in me might call a play date.
Okay.
So to speak. And so it's not uncommon to see, you know, what you might first think of as a single brood of 15, 20, 20 chicks, but it ends up being multiple broods together.
Just to finish up with the gray partridge, they're not a native bird. They were introduced, as was the pheasant. Really, the native bird for this area, you might still find, would be the bobwhite quail.
That's right. Yeah.
And, of course, the mourning dove, as far as what are considered game species now.
Right. Just stopping on the railroad tracks here.
Back up a little bit and look down that grassway row. A little bit far there. Look, all I thought I saw a head, but could have been just the
nope.
Window.
You do see a head. Two more partridge there. Am I right? You see them?
I see one of the two.
I see two adults.
I see two now. Their heads are straight up.
Yep.
One looking kind of south and one looking kind of north.
There's a rooster pheasant farther down the track, standing right in the middle of the tracks.
And of course, there's a pair of rails running down here too. That's a bird.
That's right.
Those are steel.
That is a partridge, right? Or is that a hen pheasant? Nope, those are
pheasants. Those are pheasants. Young pheasants. Yeah, they're at that size where they're easy to mistake when you're just looking at a silhouette.
Yeah.
And then finally get lit up.
I'm wondering if that's an adult hen with a single large chick, because you notice the one bird had some tail feathers on it, Mike, but
yep.
The other one doesn't. I'll pull forward just a bit. Good thing I brought you along today. So we're going to call that a hen with a single large chick. I saw tail feathers on the front bird. Or do you want to call him? I mean, that chick is dang near the size of a...
Probably first brood.
So entering our observations in our data collection system on the phone now, which is really nice, kind of a recent change, but makes things much easier on the collection end and also much quicker and easier on the post-processing end as well.
If you can do it this way, then there's not the get home and go, I got to do this before I fill out my data.
Right.
So it's probably the accuracy and integrity is better.
Yes, absolutely. What do you think, Mike? Crow size or adult pheasant size for that chick?
I'd say it was a little smaller. It wasn't quite adult. Go towards crow.
Towards crow size. 63 days is what my data collection system is telling me as an estimate of age.
So that would tell me it was probably from the first brood.
I would guess so, yeah.
Okay, we just kicked a rooster pheasant up.
We did, yeah.
Still moderate dew. Well, it's actually, I would say it's almost a heavier dew. There's a lot of droplets on the vegetation here.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Mike. I've noticed that, you know, again, like I was mentioning earlier, it's just really, for me at least, maybe not so much for others, but it's just really hard to predict good dew conditions. And what makes it even more challenging is that it's so variable. You know, we could be starting at one spot and have a, like this morning, where you and I both estimated a moderate dew, and now that we're, you know, about a third of the way through our route, it's the dew is quite heavy. In fact, when I just jumped out into the ditch there to try to flush those partridge chicks, I came out with wet feet, very wet feet. So,
well, that just is kind of an illustration that you've got little microclimates.
Absolutely.
In the habitat, it's the different habitats help determine what the climate is like as well.
Chick size.
So those were little pheasants that we just a pair of chicks, but then the adult flew out into the bean field.
Yeah.
What would you estimate those were?
Size-wise?
Size, age, fairly small. They were robin or smaller.
Yeah, probably meadowlark, about 28 days.
Okay.
Would that be about right?
You think that was maybe a second attempt at a nest that maybe one failed and... Or just a late nesting?
Yeah, it could be. It's kind of right at that age where it could be
either. Huh?
Either, yeah.
Okay.
Because you figure if the chicks are about 28 days old, the nest was initiated probably 28 days or so before that, I would think.
Yeah.
And that puts us into early June.
Well, that's the, what, second or third set of group of pheasants that we've seen on this piece of the route.
Yeah.
That's great. It's great. It's picking up a little bit.
It is. It's been a good morning so far.
All right.
Iowa Department of Natural Resources started this survey when it was the Iowa Conservation Commission back in 1962, so this survey has been going on for 60 years. There are currently 218 30-mile routes that are driven by volunteers and DNR staff. Todd Bogenschutz is the upland wildlife research biologist for the project. Weather and habitat are major factors that determine nesting success and the populations that we see. Based on this data, along with some other information, is used in determining seasons and the bag limits for the various species that are allowed for hunting. It also gives folks a good handle on some of the other species that are observed, because those are noted as well. Okay, now there was a gray partridge brood that we just kicked up in this little field entry. It looked like they were doing some scratching. What's going on there, Tyler?
Yeah, they're taking a dust bath.
Why are they doing that?
It helps them with feather care. Kind of okay. Keeps the lice and whatnot.
Yeah, so the ectoparasites and... Okay, so overall, looks like we had a pretty good morning, would you say?
Yeah, I just checked and we had 15 individual observations. We had what? 2 pheasant broods, 2 partridge broods,
mm-hmm.
Some cottontails.
Cottontails.
Yeah, it's a good morning. Very good morning.
Yeah. Well, of course, we saw a lot of the other interesting birds and a few deer. And it's great to get out in the morning to do something like this. So.
It is indeed.
Yeah. Now, Tyler, you've got another survey that you're starting. Is this maybe the second year on this survey having to do with chimney swifts?
Yeah, so we're starting an effort here in central Iowa, mostly in Ames and Nevada right now, monitoring chimney swift roofs during late summer. I'd say this is the first official year, if you want to call it that.
Okay.
I took interest in this with a few other folks last year, and we did monitor the roost at the Octagon Center for the Arts building in Ames, mm-hmm. somewhat loosely last summer. And this year I have a number of folks that were interested in helping monitor or count the number of swifts that are entering roost chimneys at both the Octagon Center again and also a building in Nevada right near the Story County Administration building.
Okay, so that's a building that would be east of the administration building in Nevada.
That's correct.
Why the interest?
Well, you know, chimney swifts are a really interesting bird, and we don't know much about them at all, other than that they do belong to a group of birds called aerial insectivores, and there's a lot of research that shows that aerial insectivore populations are declining across North America. There's interest and I think good reason to be monitoring populations of these birds in some manner. Doing roost surveys during migration is one way that we can do that. There are other ways as well, but this is a good way and in a somewhat simple way to monitor them, and it's a really nice way to engage citizen scientists or volunteers that are interested in doing this also.
The swifts are native to North America, at least what we call the chimney swifts. Where did they live before we had chimneys built?
Yeah, that's a great question. So they historically would nest in hollow trees, mm-hmm. and likely still do nest in hollow trees to reasonable extent. But, you know, they're one of those species of birds that benefited greatly from our creations.
Mm-hmm.
Chimneys that were built as areas were being developed historically were, at least to a chimney swift, looked a heck of a lot like a hollow tree. I had a young birder ask me one time, which came first, the name chimney swift or the fact that they nested in chimneys? And I still don't know the answer to that question, but I thought it was a very good one.
Very perceptive. That's you talked about, you know, some of the things we do and how wildlife will adapt. A bluebird would be another example.
Yeah.
You know, fence posts, those kinds of structures.
Yeah.
Shorter grass areas in some cases, because I think, at least in the case of the bluebird, probably grazing by the bison and the elk created some of those shorter grasses that they would like to look for insects over. So
yeah.
A chimney swift, you're calling an aerial insectivore.
Yeah.
What would you say is their primary insect? Do they have, has anybody done research on that?
I don't think so. Again, they're catching insects on the wing or while flying, and so anything that's up there they can capture. So I'm sure mosquitoes, moths, those sorts of things, they're
sure
going to be captured.
Probably mayflies or those
sure
kinds of things. Anything aerial.
Yeah.
Do they spend a lot of time on wing other than in their roost in the chimney? What can you tell me a little bit about their behavior or natural history?
Yeah, so they spend almost all of their time on the wing, at least when they're out and about. In fact, they're said to be one of the most aerial of any bird in North America. They feed on the wing, they bathe on the wing. You know, really about the only time that they're going to touch ground, if you will, is when they roost at night in chimneys. And then during the nesting season, they build their nests inside chimneys and hollow mm-hmm trees. And so they'll touch ground or touch some sort of structure during that time. But outside of that, they're almost always on the wing.
And the nest materials are kind of an interesting material. I know we had an old chimney. We took it down in a manner that we wanted to reuse the bricks, the materials. And we came across an old nest. And it was a nest built of sticks held together by saliva.
Yeah, that's right. They have a very sticky saliva that they use to hold their nest together. At least one of few birds that have that adaptation.
Ooh, okay,
for nest building.
They must chew a lot of gum or something to keep that salivary gland going.
That could be.
Okay, now with this survey that you're conducting, I understand you're also interested in keeping track of nighthawks at the same time?
Yeah, so we're monitoring nighthawks as well, mostly opportunistically, but they're another species of aerial insectivore that are a bit more nocturnal than chimney swifts. So chimney swifts are out in the day, and nighthawks are foraging mostly at night. The neat thing about both of these birds that I think also makes them an interesting and worthwhile pair of birds to monitor is that they're commonly found in urban areas. Oftentimes, I think we are somewhat jaded, I guess, about, you know, what potential wildlife you can observe in urban settings. And I think chimney swifts and common nighthawks are two good examples of birds that will readily utilize these areas and are native species and are both pretty unique in terms of their life history.
Now, I know nighthawks, I've associated them with gravelly areas or, for example, in Wisconsin, there's whippoorwills, nighthawks, those members that are of the same family group. Rocks and pebbles and those kinds of things are where I've seen, and I've only seen a couple because they're well camouflaged, seen them in those kinds of areas. What do they do in town?
They can use large gravelly parking lots if there are any parking lots like that in these urban areas. What they're more likely using is rock rooftops of buildings, flat rocky rooftops of, you know, one of the interesting or perhaps troubling things about urban areas that could be impacting both chimney swifts and common nighthawks is the way that we build buildings now. There's not many buildings that have brick chimneys anymore, and there's not many buildings that have rock rooftops anymore, and so there's concern that the changing of our construction practices could be impacting the availability of nesting areas for these birds. And at least for chimney swifts, I know there's been a little bit of research done on that, and at this point scientists feel like chimneys for nesting are actually not a limiting factor impacting chimney swift populations. That's more likely other factors like loss of food or things mm-hmm like that. But as you know, things continue to change, that could be something to consider and keep an eye on.
And speaking of swifts, I know that there have been some structures that have been designed and built to substitute for chimneys. Can you share anything about that? Are you aware of those?
Yeah, so conservation groups have taken an interest in building wooden artificial chimneys that are generally placed on the ground. The hope and goal for those structures is that chimney swifts will utilize them, I think primarily for roosting areas. I'm not sure that they're used for nesting, really, but they could be. The origin of those wooden chimneys actually comes from Iowa, which is another neat thing about chimney swifts. Althea Sherman, who was an ornithologist and science teacher from Northeast Iowa, built the first wooden artificial chimney to study nesting chimney swifts. And she built little observation windows and throughout the chimney so that she could actually watch chimney swifts nest and observe their nesting behavior and how they feed their young. And some of the early understanding of that portion of the chimney swift's life cycle came from Althea Sherman's work with native Iowans. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dr. Harms, Tyler, thank you for letting me go on the survey with you this morning, and thanks for the information. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks to you, Mike. I appreciated your keen observation skills this morning.
Dr. Tyler Harms, biometrician with the Department of Natural Resources.
And that was the Young Rascals' Beautiful Morning, and it sure is a beautiful morning. It's 68 degrees out there. Quite a relief considering what we went through this weekend. On the line I have Melissa Spencer with Story County Emergency Management. Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
I'm glad you could join us this morning. Let's just do some general information today. I know you've been in this position for a couple of short months now, is that correct?
Yeah, I have moved up to coordinator, and it's been, I guess it has been 2 months now. Time flies.
Yeah, it sure does. And gosh, you got right into the heat of the battle, all puns intended. It's been pretty rough out there for folks. What or how do you handle heat stress, or what do you share with folks here in the community when it comes to heat and what we can do as far as finding relief?
Well, you know, here in Story County, you know, we're very lucky that we have some public spaces that are open, such as the Ames Library does open and allow people in to seek respite from the heat. And also, you know, I recommend people just, you know, even just go to the mall and spend some time trying to get out of the heat, you know, taking those frequent breaks from those really hot afternoons is important. And also staying hydrated, you know, water is still the best thing to have on those warm days.
Mm-hmm.
But also recognizing maybe when you're not starting to feel so well, you know, feeling dizzy, feeling nauseous, getting muscle cramps. When you start feeling those, that's the early signs of the heat exhaustion. And that's your body warning you, hey, let's try to get into a cooler environment, get some cool water in us, take a rest, and just take a break for a little bit.
Yeah, I know one thing personally that happens to me if I begin getting dehydrated, a headache for me is my first sign. So, you know, it's hot out there and I'm doing some work and I start feeling a headache come on. Boy, it doesn't take much water to and just sit down for a minute or two and back to normal and ready to go.
Take it easy. You know, those warning signs are telling, you know, like you said, are telling you to go inside, sit down, take it easy. Because if you don't, you know, it certainly can progress onto heat stroke, where your body actually stops sweating, and you may even pass out. It truly can become a life-threatening situation on these really hot and humid days. But luckily, it seems like this morning and a little bit into this week, we're going to get a little bit of break from those real high 90 temperatures.
Yeah, it's a timely arrival of this relief. I know that especially for those folks that are out, have to work outdoors, hopefully they're taking more frequent breaks. Supervisors are allowing them to do that, seeking shade, staying hydrated. It's this time of year when you know the roofers are starting before the sun rises and construction workers. And another thing for members of the public, I think, is that you really need to give them a break because they're working under a stressful situation to begin with and then add heat to that. Remember, you're in most cases, an air-conditioned vehicle, and they're not always as observant as to their surroundings, so just watch out when you're a construction area. That's why we post those lower speed limits.
Oh, yeah, and you know, if you're, even for yourself, if you have plans to be doing any work outside, you know, really taking advantage of the cooler mornings to get some of that heavy construction type work done, you know, starting earlier. You know, if your neighbor's getting their house re-roofed, you know, be cognizant that if it's a really hot day, some of those construction workers are going to want to maybe start a little earlier in the morning. Might make a little more noise than you're used to in the morning. But like you said, show them some courtesy because they're trying to get that work done so they don't become overcome by the heat throughout the day.
Right. I'm going to ask you, Melissa, if you would be willing to share, how are you adapting? How does it feel to be the coordinator now after beginning about 2 months? You find any? Have you found any stress or are you kind of settling in?
Well, you know, currently right now, I'm kind of doing the work of two positions. I'm a solo office right now because I moved up from the deputy coordinator position into the coordinator position. There's been a little bit of stress trying to do the job of two people,
mm-hmm.
but hopefully here soon, hoping by September sometime, we'll have additional staff on board. I am lucky enough right now to have an intern from Iowa State University. I have a Samantha Sharper, who is a junior at Iowa State, finishing her criminal justice degree, is going to be with me here for the next year. So she's been a bit of a help during this interim time of getting fully staffed. And she's been doing some really great work for us that, you know, quite frankly, sometimes there's not enough hours in the day. So she's taking on some projects for our office that we've just not really had a chance to dig into. So I'm really happy to have her on board with us for at least this next year, and really excited to see the work that she's going to do for us. So hopefully we should be fully staffed here pretty soon, and my stress level should go down.
Well, I really appreciate your willingness to join us this morning because of that. So you're working, because you're the county emergency management office, you work with all of the communities within the county, the volunteer fire departments, med techs, those kinds of folks, correct?
Yeah, for us, for the Emergency Management Agency, we actually our structure is actually done through a commission, which is made up of a representative from all the jurisdictions, one representative from the Board of Supervisors, and the sheriff. So that allows this agency to work equally for every community, big or small, because everybody has one voice and can help direct the projects that the office does. You know, and so it's really a bit unique that we work for everyone equally. You know, and then we also help be a hub for coordination for any disaster or emergency that would happen to any of our communities. We kind of call ourselves that little voice over the shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
We're there to coordinate. We're there to help them find the resources they need to deal with those issues that come up during some type of disaster or an emergency that could impact their community. You know, so it is unique because we get to coordinate with a lot of folks, like you said, the fire, the EMS, the law enforcement. We also get to work with a lot of public and private partnerships too, because being a two-person office, all the remits of this office can't be accomplished by two people.
Mm-hmm.
So really developing those public and private partnerships is hugely beneficial for us to continue to build the preparedness and resiliency of the county.
Well, it sounds like you could perhaps use some volunteers. Now, I know it takes some training, but where would people find out if they wanted to help out? Where would they go?
We actually do have a volunteer in our office that right now that is helping with a scanning project for us. Retired Senior Volunteer Program has the ability to sign up volunteers that would like to help in disaster situations. So if we would have something happen, they are the agency that organizes the volunteers for us. People can sign up ahead of time to be a disaster volunteer. So it's Central Iowa RSVP is an organization that does that. They certainly can feel free to contact us through our Facebook page, Story County Emergency Management. We have a Facebook page. They could reach out to us if they're interested. And then also through the county's webpage, we have our contact information there. They can certainly feel free to reach out to us if they would like to help out with anything.
Great. So would that page be the place if folks wanted to find out more information, say, on disaster relief?
Yeah. Also, during times of disaster, we would be sharing information on any of the disaster or emergency programs. Would also go out through our Facebook page, as well as we would have a section created for, depending on the disaster or emergency that was going on, we would be also sharing information there. Our Facebook page, we do try to share a lot of preparedness information, a lot of information when the severe weather alerts come out, just trying to help people be aware of what's going on here in Story County and how it could impact them.
Okay. A question on if somebody observes something, during the monthly test for the outdoor sirens, how do we go about reporting those? Who do report to if one of those isn't working properly?
Actually, if you find that an outdoor warning siren in your community is not working, you really need to contact your city hall, because the cities themselves are responsible for the functionality of the siren there within the community. And so if they aren't aware that it's not working, then they really are the ones that need to know, because they're the ones that are also going to bring out their technician, because there's several different companies that provide outdoor warning sirens. But they're going to know who to bring out so they can take a look at it, do testing, and make sure that it is operational. But we recommend that people contact their city hall.
Well, that's great to know. Melissa, we've got a minute or two left. Is there any message or anything that you can think of to share with our folks, our listeners out there?
You know, one thing that's very important is just to be aware. Be aware of what's going on around you. We have a great system, Story County Iowa Alerts, that you can sign up to get alerts if there's some type of emergency that will be going on in the community that can provide direction. It also, people also have the can choose to receive severe weather alerts through the Story County Iowa Alert system. And if they just go to our webpage, we have links on how they can sign up for that service.
Okay, and we'll be sure to include that webpage connection on our local site as well. Melissa Spencer, thank you very much for taking time out to speak with us this morning, and we look forward to visiting with you next month, and hopefully we won't have any emergencies come up so you folks can kind of get caught up and you can settle in gradually so that when an emergency does come into play, you're at your best. And we know you will be. So thanks again for joining us, Melissa. That's Melissa Spencer, Story County Emergency Management Coordinator for Story County. Mike, I just want to ask you real quickly, how's it feel for you? We've got some great weather coming up here today and perhaps tomorrow.
We do indeed, yeah. So I guess the key word is relief. I mean, you know, the extreme heat can be detrimental to people's health. And so when anything less than that is much appreciated. And and it's a good chance. It looks like today might be a good day to get outside.
Yeah, and I think one way for folks to get some relief and pleasure is take time to take a break. And while you're taking that break, if you can, listen to KHOI, and we've got some great music and information, and people can settle back and with a hydrating drink and just enjoy themselves. So, yeah, I appreciate that, Mike. I want to thank you, Mike, for engineering today's program. I also want to pass on a tip of the chapeau to Lynn Carey for all her assistance. And it's a big thank you for KHOI's Dennis Hart for his excellent summary of our local news. And you also heard from Story County Emergency Manager Melissa Spencer, as well as Dr. Tyler Harms, the biometrician with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. I have been your host, Mike Metz. Remember that you can also hear this online at khoifm.org and find links to our guests and information you heard during this program. Please consider becoming a member and making KHOI your community radio station. With your financial support, you can go to our website at khoifm.org and press that yellow donate button to begin the process of becoming a member. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!, followed by Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting KHOI, and we'll see you again on the radio.
This is Democracy Now!